Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston. We're recording this episode on a Monday morning, just a few days after Manchester United won 2-0 against Everton. I'm joined by Samuel Luckhurst as usual, and in this episode, Samuel, we're going to analyse whether Kay Middleton's photo is photoshopped or not, and the Princess of Wales. Is it photoshopped, Samuel? Did the Palace tweak that image?
I'm worried for Simon Peach's reputation, because PA are the only photo agency who have not pulled it due to their relationship with the royal family. But so I'll have to take him to task on that later in the week. But I wouldn't want to venture anywhere near that rabbit hole of conspiracy theories online.
I actually noticed that a few hours before it was taken down, all that order, kill order was sent out. Mm. I was looking into it. I was thinking, surely this is a load of rubbish. It turns out there's something to it. So maybe conspiracy theorists have something going on.
Mm, who knows?
That's another conversation for another podcast. It is very Joe Rogan. And we're here to talk about Manchester United 2, Everton 0. Samuel, a very strange game, because another 3 points for United, a very important 3 points. But it was another game where the opposition created a ton of chances. And I guess on another day, it could have been a very different game.
It was such an uninspiring win that there were two questions about expected goals at the press conference afterwards.
I was going to mention this, and I laughed when I saw the quotes, because I thought you should.
I think the most excited I got all day was just approaching the press room entrance, and Gary Oldman was coming in my opposite direction, and he's genuinely probably my favourite actor since I was a kid. So. Which kind of gives you an idea of the lack of parental guidance my parents had in terms of the films I was able to get away with watching at such a young age. But in terms of the match, it when you look at the scoreline, when you look at the fact that United had two penalties to score those goals, that is pretty much how it played out. I mean, Everton, they started well, their intent was good pretty much throughout the game, but whenever you watch them, you never have any faith that they're going to score. There's
can't
a reason
score
why.
Toffee, can they?
No,
for us. There you go.
Yeah, I saw you tweet that. You're very proud of yourself for that. But Sheffield United and Burnley are the only teams who've scored fewer goals in the Premier League away from home this season. And whether it's Dominic Calvert-Lewin or whether it's Beto up front, you sense that you're not going to be caused much fuss with that. And I suppose the only thing that you look at it from that aspect where United are failing again are the sheer number of attempts that have been unleashed at their goal. And like with the whole expected goals thing, I know we covered it and had a little debate about it on Friday, but sometimes I'm of the opinion that you don't need it, because you look at that game and even the 3 minute highlights that they put out on YouTube on the rights holder channels, I think there might have been one Everton chance that they showed, and that was in the second half when the lad who came on, his shot went out for a throw-in. So that's how hopeless they are in front of goal. And United did create or had shots that were more memorable or they had better openings. And with Everton, I think for that game to have been interesting at the weekend, Everton either needed to score first or they had to equalise. And when it was 1-0 and Everton were still doing quite well, I even wrote in the blog, the likelihood is that United will go 2-0 up rather than this goes 1-1. And they were two gimmies. I mean, Dyche was, as per normal, he was moaning at the fourth official, the linesman, the referee. But the two fouls that Tarkowski and Godfrey, I mean, by God, how bad was he, that they gave away were just so brainless. Just the most obvious penalties. I mean, whoever was on the VAR, there was no need to hit the rewind button looking at those two incidents. They were such cast iron penalties. And really, I think if you're one of the rights holders showing that game, you're almost duty bound to ramp it up and make it more interesting than it was. And of course, with Garnacho being named the man of the match and a lot of focus on his performance, and he did very well, even with his performance, you've come away from it thinking he had two really good goal scoring opportunities and he cocked up both of them. But that's just part of his developments. We've discussed before, I think the way he's going, he'll probably win the Smack Busby Player of the Year award, and rightly so. And he's what started 23 games on the trot now, two home games running. He's elicited four yellow cards from Fulham players. He's earned two penalties against Everton. His trajectory since he came into the team has just it's not wavered at all. That bar one injury, that ankle injury against Southampton last season, it doesn't feel like he's had a real colossal setback. I know he started the season.
There's been a few games where he's felt a bit lightweight and his performances haven't been the best. I mean, City away, you can forgive him for that.
Yeah.
And he still is only 19 years old. So
exactly.
I mean, I got a bit of stick. I tweeted the other week, I went, he's having the finest career of his the finest season of his career, and someone rightly pointed out it's his first full season. He's literally 19.
Well, last season was his first full season because he was on the bench.
I guess they were making the point having a run of games, and I thought very fair point.
Yeah, yeah.
A stupid tweet.
I think if I was subbing your tweets, I'd have maybe.
I agree. But it was rushed out after a game. I was busy with the blog, match coverage, etc. Ty made the point during the game that if Sean Dyche had hair, he'd probably be pulling that out, because as an Everton fan, you must be so frustrated watching your team. They're getting plenty of good positions around the box, but they're just devoid of ideas, and they kind of panic, don't they, when they get into the final third. They've got no penetration, no breakthrough, and obviously they didn't score, because for all those chances, as you say, it didn't look like scoring, didn't look like finding the back of the net. Garnacho, you've just mentioned Bruno Fernandes, excellent as well, really sharp.
Yeah, it was.
So
yeah.
I thought them two were probably the two standout performers attacking wise. Rashford, I thought, was really good as well.
I thought in the first half he was pretty good. I thought in the first half the front three were on song, and that really made the goals happen. Of course, Garnacho had that those really productive surges, and Dyche, as you said, as Ty said, he if he did have hair, he would have been pulling it out, especially at the second penalty. Just how he's allowed to carry the ball that far.
It must be so frustrating for a manager. You prepare your team all week, you work on your shape, your tactics, your plan, and you rock up to Old Trafford, and within half an hour, your players have committed suicidal errors. They're just brainless tackles, those. I mean, they were needless.
Was Seamus Coleman on the bench as well? Because he turned up at the game, and I know he's...
It was a gift to United, though, wasn't it? Everton gifted that result.
Yeah, I mean, Seamus Coleman as a Premier League player has been past it for a while, but he's a good professional. I know he might have had a tougher time than Godfrey did against Garnacho, but I genuinely don't think he'd have been any worse than Godfrey. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Godfrey was being talked up for a possible England call up, or he was going to be the next big thing. And clearly the next big thing at Everton is Jarrod Branthwaite. But yeah, going into that game, I mean, it played out as I thought it would. I thought it would be an uninspiring United win where they won't take Everton to the cleaners, because they don't take any team to the cleaners. They've only won, I think it's six games now this season by a margin of two goals or more, and two of them have been against Everton.
Is that not just so frustrating though, Samuel? I mean, fans leaving Old Trafford on Saturday afternoon, delighted with the 3 points, and at the end of the day,
I think delighted is stretching.
Well, I'm not delighted with the 3 points, but the same conversation's being had every time. You can pick holes in the performance, it's unconvincing, and as I said, I think any other team, a better side, a top 10 side, would have made a game of that.
I think
it's
one of those games where I'm kind of almost in awe at supporters who make the long journey there, because to travel all that way for a win that is as uninspiring as that, and it's difficult to think for another word but that. But United should be looking to entertain them against Everton, who barely score any goals, and when they did have goal scoring chances, they never looked like scoring goals. And it's a case of like give something back to the supporters. And then Ten Hag came out afterwards. I think one of his quotes was, "We're back." I mean, come on, nobody is advising you to say that. And he is coming out with some strange sound bites recently, and that's understandable because there is a lot of pressure on him. And it's not a coincidence that he is starting to say things that he wouldn't have said last season, because things have changed. His authority isn't as absolute, and in your SAR looking at potential replacements should they decide to change manager in the summer. But you want to go to United and you want to be surprised by them. And the times where we've come away from Old Trafford this season and you've looked at fans and fans could almost float out of the ground, they've been after late wins. It's been the Boxing Day game, which was probably that, and the Brentford game. They're the two main highlights. And West Ham was an uplifting win. I thought that was a really good win as well, considering West Ham were above them. But more often than not, United at home this season, they've really underwhelmed, and you've got to get out of that habit, because that wasn't the case last season. They were Old Trafford was a fortress last season, and there were a plethora of great wins where you know, for us, it's great because you can, you know, you've got all the positive coverage and you've got a lot of angles to go at. But that game at the weekend, I think looking at it from a journalistic perspective, I think to even dwell on that game is pointless, which is not great for us because there's not another game until Sunday. But in terms of taking things out from that, there's no real minutiae from that game that one would want to dissect. And I know some out there will want to dissect it, and I can't quite understand why they would. But it's just one of those games that, as a friend who he's a season ticket holder, he said to me after the game, he said, that's a game nobody will remember.
There was a guy from the States, I don't know what the lounge is called in Old Trafford, but it's where you can have drinks and stuff after the game. I think it's the nicer seats. In the interview at MUTV, I asked him, what do you think of that game? And he bluntly said, rubbish. And obviously they put a very positive spin on everything. But we won. He went, yeah, but we should be beating Everton way more stylishly and more convincingly than we did. United have now conceded at least 20 shots in 4 of the last 5 games. I mean, it really highlights the problems, doesn't it? And we say problems because we are being quite critical, even when they win. But if you do that consistently, it's just not sustainable, that the chickens.
And who's coming on Sunday?
Well, exactly. You definitely can't do that against Liverpool.
No.
I mean, I just made a comment there to our colleague, our City reporter, Joe Breer, that it's like watching a different sport when you watch City, Liverpool. The games are so high octane, intense. Yeah. It's amazing.
I said that, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, that obviously, you know, decades ago, schoolboys, schoolgirls, they would go and watch United at home 1 week, they'd go watch City at home the next week. If you did that now, you would think you're watching a different sport, just the intensity, the incision, the quality. And look, United might pull a rabbit out of the hat on Sunday and do what they did against Liverpool at home last season, where hardly anybody gave them a prayer. And on that balmy, uproarious night, they were absolutely... They were phenomenal wins, particularly in the first half, and they got a 2-1 win, and that kickstarted the Ten Hag era. But watching that game yesterday between Liverpool and City, I mean, City were better in the first half. Liverpool were back with a vengeance in the second half, and unfortunate not to have the one shot to win it at the death, because I thought it should have been a penalty for Doku's foul on McAllister. And you just wonder, will United buck up their ideas against one of the best teams in Europe?
Isn't it amazing, though? I mean, when you look at that, that's Liverpool's starting team yesterday. On paper, I don't want to not give them the credit they deserve, but it doesn't look that good.
No.
City, yeah, they're flying at the top of the league, challenging for the title. Obviously, Klopp's last season's got a lot to do with it. But you look on paper, and City, you thought, would have comfortably beaten Liverpool. But they played excellent. The second half particularly, obviously, City fell off a bit, but Liverpool ended the half really, really well.
But that was a game yesterday that you could get your teeth stuck into. Like, for one, it's not a coincidence that City's only win at Anfield since 2003 was when the turnstiles were locked. There was someone at City in the comms department who got a bit annoyed by a question regarding that I think it was when they were both going for the title a couple of seasons ago. Like,
I mean, that's not particularly a dig at City, that's just a fact, isn't it?
No, that is. Like, look at the games Liverpool lost at home that season. When United got a point there, everyone thought, myself included, that's quite a good point. Then Liverpool went on this losing run where Burnley beat them, Fulham beat them, Everton beat them, City beat them. All these teams who haven't won at Anfield in donkey's years won at Anfield. And there's a reason for that, because the mythical Anfield atmosphere did not exist. And there's a reason why Liverpool finished below United that season. But of course, United, because they were run by rugby enthusiasts who didn't know what they were doing, gave the manager a new contract, and then they had to sack him in the November. And you know, that was one fascinating aspect of that game yesterday. But the other part of it was that, because Ten Hag, going a little bit back to Friday now, and he's pretty much press conference on Friday centred almost solely on injuries and the excuse of injuries. At the first half of the season, he was like, it's not an excuse. Now, it is the biggest excuse going. But you look down the road at Liverpool and what Liverpool are doing, and you think, I'm sorry, but you do not have an excuse there, because also, you've spent quite a lot of money on this squad. So, although you've inherited some dross here and there, and there's the, you know, that piece of unwanted furniture over there that's called Anthony Marshall, you know, this is still your squad, and you've bought badly. Whereas at Liverpool, they buy well by and large. They've had a good rebuild so far in the summer. Yes, the Klopp aspect, the emotion of that comes into it as well. And also, he's given kids a chance. I mean, at the weekend, Ahmad doesn't get on again. Anthony's coming on again. You see Anthony, and when his name was announced, there wasn't, I wasn't expecting boos, and there weren't any boos, but there wasn't a single cheer either, which is telling of a player's popularity. It's almost like, why is he on? Okay, Toby Collier may never be good enough for United. Dermot Mee even on the bench, but why is the second goalkeeper on the bench? And you just thought, look, there's an open, there's the open goal there of the 250th Academy graduate to come on, make his debut, and you pass that up as well. It's just, it's not difficult to get fans on side, to you know, stir emotions, to get fans excited. I don't think it's as difficult as Ten Hag's making it out to be. And then after such an uninspiring win, I didn't do the press conference because I made the mistake of going to the mix zone for an hour and speaking to a brick wall, effectively.
I've not seen.
No. It was...
Literally a brick wall.
That was the most communication we got from United. But the press conference afterwards, the fact that it centred on... that there were quite a few questions about the shots that are being aimed at United, that gives you an idea of what kind of win it was. And it's not... this is not us being negative. I'm sure there are people out there saying you're being negative again. We're not. I mean, United are sixth on the table for a reason. They are scoring as few goals as they are for a reason. And look, if they win on Sunday, and it doesn't matter how they win on Sunday, as long as they win, then they absolutely will go into the spring internationals with a spring in their step. But in terms of the warm-up act for it, I think it'd be safe to put Liverpool down as favourites for that game on Sunday, despite the injuries that they've had to contend with of late.
Talked about Ten Hag's change in approach and how he's actually assessing these performances, I think, on the last podcast, but it is really interesting. It is notable. Last season, constructive criticism. He's quite honest and sometimes brutal. I mean, he just said how it is. But to come out in the press conference after Saturday's game and say, conceding that many chances or shots, sorry, isn't a problem and he wasn't concerned about it. It's another example, isn't it? It's the latest example of a change in approach. And I think you can just put that down to pressure. He's under immense pressure, isn't he? And when you're under immense pressure, you might say things that particularly don't fit with your character or what you actually believe. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but that's what it seems like to me. We'll leave it there for part one. I'll be back in a moment for part two. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester Is Red podcast. I'm Samuel. Andre Onana, very good again. Seems like he's turned the corner. I talked to him in the mix zone after the opening game of the season. You talked to him after the Nottingham Forest game in the FA Cup. I think we can both agree he's a very likeable personality. And I was watching his MUTV interview as well. I just think he comes across brilliantly. He's always got a smile on his face. He's laughing. And it seems like he's got a weight lift off his shoulders at the moment. He seems like he's way more relaxed, calm. And like I say, I think turning the corner is the key phrase here. I think in 2024, he has been very good and he was very decent again against Everton. It's how refreshing is it that on this podcast, we're talking about positive goalkeeping performances instead of the first half of the season and last season with David Ayer, where we kept on talking about quite poor goalkeeping performances.
I think with the saves he made, you'd expect a goalkeeper to make them, but his handling at crosses...
There was definitely a confidence
about him that wasn't there at the first half of the season. And he told us at Forest that he had more issues off the pitch in terms of settling and adjusting. He said that going from Amsterdam to Milan, he found that easy. And again, this is an example of the scrutiny players come under when they go to United and how much scrutiny there is on them. And of course, if you're being scrutinised that thoroughly, there's going to be pressure. And of course, in his first game, he was very fortunate not to give away a penalty. But since he came back from AFCON, I thought his performance against Aston Villa was overrated, but by and large, he has been good. And he's not made an error, I don't think, for a goal. I think maybe at Luton he could have been quicker to come out and maybe smother the... Or try and be a bit more difficult to beat when Carlton Morris scored. But that's almost nitpicking. I think he radiates confidence more. I think players are not as uncertain with him behind them. And Wayne Rooney was saying the other week that the goalkeeper, from his experience at management, he says that the goalkeeper's the most important player in the team.
It sets the tone, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he dictates the way you play. And he is very likable. And it would have been, he was the one, originally we were due to speak to him in the mix zone on Saturday, and then that didn't happen. And I mean, what we wanted to ask him as well was, has he retired from international duty? Because he was in exile for 9 months. He joined Man United, suddenly he's back in the squad. And it seemed like he was messed around a bit over AFCON in that, you know, he was trying to keep both parties, club and country, you know, happy. He arrived, didn't play in the first game, started in the second game, lost to Senegal, didn't do very well at all for Sadio Mane's goal, and then he was dropped.
And there's some historical issues with Cameroon there, the Qatar World Cup, and I think there has been a suggestion actually that Samuel Eto'o, who's the president of the federation out there, he actually picks the team, and I think he clashes with
Ringo Bersong isn't the coach anymore, well, I don't think.
So I think he's actually the one who calls the shots, and there have been some bizarre comments from Eto'o in the past on Onana, and that's the reason he withdrew.
There were some bizarre comments from Eto'o when he was a player as well.
And obviously he's come out of retirement. I can imagine him kind of coming in and out of international football.
He's a very bolshy character, Eto'o. I mean, he was an exceptional striker as well, and I think he feels emboldened to be that way, but he could be quite outspoken when he was a player. But I don't think Cameroon have got any fixtures this month, so I mean, there's not an issue there. But going forward, I think it would be in United's interests, because when they signed him, they pretty much said to us that they signed him partly under the assumption, or that they were assured that him and Cameroon, that was done. There was no going back there.
I'm surprised they believe that. I'm surprised that was said.
I think
you always get the indication with players.
I half wonder that if he'd stayed at Inter Milan, did Cameroon calling him up? Probably not. I think the prominence of a Manchester United player.
You look at the other options for Cameroon, though. I mean, the goalkeeper
is his cousin.
Exactly, yeah. In the French third tier.
Yeah.
And they were in a position above the relegation zone, the French third tier, when AFCON was on.
There can be a lot of politics with certain international teams, and emotions can run high, and look, it didn't end up well for Cameroon, and they weren't necessarily better off without Onana, because they, as I said, they went out of the first knockout stage.
Did you know that he speaks Spanish, Italian, obviously English and French, four languages? He revealed that with MUT after.
He played for Barcelona's academy.
When he was a teenager, he moved to Spain. But I just thought that was so impressive. What kind of praise, yeah, Bruno Fernandes, you have in the past for being that glue in that dressing room, for being able to communicate in multiple different languages. And to do that is a huge skill. When you look at that back four, to be able to communicate with your players in different languages, I think that's brilliant.
I think Diogo Dalot can do it as well. I think he can speak Spanish. Obviously, he speaks Portuguese, and his English has been impeccable since he came to the club. So you can't underestimate having those characters. And Ten Hag clearly likes those characters as well. When he was at Ajax, and this is probably quite commonplace in certain clubs across Europe, it's Thomas Tuchel certainly done it, or he may not still be doing it, but he did it early in the season with Bayern Munich. They address these continental teams, they're addressed in English. And Ten Hag, I mean, I know there was a lot of chatter about, was his English good enough ahead of coming to United? But he was addressing Ajax players in English. There's that great clip in Louis van Gaal's documentary where he turns up at Ajax to gift his book to anyone and everyone. And Ten Hag's addressing the players in English. And he says, now I'm going to hand over to Mr. van Gaal. And van Gaal, of course, starts speaking in Dutch. He says, I'm going to do this in Dutch because if I was still the manager, you'd be learning Dutch. Which is
fair enough.
It's very Louis van Gaal, but maybe not quite the modern method that other coaches swear by. But going back to Onana's form, his approval ratings have gone up a hell of a lot in the last couple of months. And I maintain, I think he should have got Foden's goal in the derby, but up until then he was playing really well. It was one of those mistakes where he's gone from an 8 out of 10 to a 6 out of 10 in the player ratings. That was a savable goal. And by the end of the season, I think he'll have let in terms of savable shots that have ended up as a goal, it'll have gone well into double figures, which isn't great. But there is always bound to be a period of adjustment when you're the Manchester United goalkeeper, irrespective of your age. And I think that was the disappointing thing in the first half of the season. He came to United as pretty much a ready-made goalkeeper with a lot of experience. It was the polar opposite to when De Gea came in as a 20-year-old, I think he would have been. And Onana did, yeah, he was as error-prone as De Gea was when he was quite a callow goalkeeper coming in back in 2011.
I think Alisson's the best goalkeeper in the league. And if someone told you in September that Onana would have more clean sheets than Alisson by the beginning of March.
And Alisson's been
injured. I know he has been injured a little bit, but I mean, even still, only David Raya's got more clean sheets than Onana.
And David Raya's not particularly good at.
He's rubbish.
It's the misleading thing about the clean sheets.
I know it is a lot of rubbish, the Golden Glove Award.
No. I think the Golden Glove Award, assigning it to an individual, I disagree with, because I think it's a collective.
Well, that's why Ten Hag called the team on the pitch. I mean, yeah. Maybe David De Gea had something to say.
He also probably thought about, well, this is his send-off.
Yeah, let's have a thought. He deserves a testimonial, as I've said. Johnny Evans, Samuel, good performance.
He was good again. Yeah.
You talked about Garnacho being in the running for the Sir Mal Busby Award, but, I mean, Johnny Evans is definitely in contention as well. Surprise package of the season. I think when he came into training to maintain fitness in the summer, if you told him that he was starting against Erling Haaland home and away, he would have thought, oh, God, I wasn't expecting that. But he's been fantastic, to be fair to him. I've made the case that I would give him another deal.
I chatted with a contact about this just towards the end of the game. We were both in agreement that he's probably worth it as a fifth choice backup.
There is going to be defensive departures. There is going to be perhaps Ferran leaving, for example, maybe Harry Maguire. And I think he is just...
I think Lindelof's likely.
There you go. So yeah. There's a lot of uncertainty anyways in that department.
There's one senior centre-half who's guaranteed to be there next season. That's Martinez.
He's the first name on the team sheet centre-half-wise, but... Yeah, I'd just give him a deal because he's a reliable option. I think injuries were a massive concern before he signed. He obviously struggled at Leicester.
He's been available for most of the season. Just a thigh strain that he got against Copenhagen, wasn't it?
Every challenge, every time that he's been needed, he stepped up to the plate. And fair play, Johnny Evans.
Yeah, and when you looked at him during the derby, I mean, he was knackered in the first half, as you would be. The physical toil on that. Coming up against City, and also the mental side of it, where you've got to be concentrating every nanosecond against a team of that quality. And he did well to last as long as he did, and that it was almost a damning indictment on United that they hit the skids when Evans went off. I think him going off was probably more of a blow than when Rashford had to go off. And credit to...
He'd already stopped attacking by that point, and that's the thing. Rashford has already been ineffective.
Yeah, I mean, the ice baths must have worked wonders, because 6 days later, he started another Premier League game, and he's undeniably, you know, and understandably very popular with supporters, going back to his days in the academy and being involved in title winning United sides. He was involved in three title wins. He's a boyhood United fan. I must admit, when I saw the picture of him when he was packed going back into Carrington, I thought, I bet they'll sign him, which they did. And at the time you thought, this seems a bit ill-advised. It seems to be something that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would do. And it wasn't a great start when he came on for his second debut against Arsenal and was a little bit all over the place.
Was the turning point when he played it to...
It was excellent. Burnley.
He was fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that night...
It's pretty harsh to say turning point, because he was before that.
I think everybody looked at that performance and thought... And I think he pretty much said it himself afterwards, that whatever happens this season, he'll always have Turf Moor. And... credit to him. He's not been satisfied with that. He's what I like about him, and you see him the way he conducts himself. He's a grown up, and as Solskjaer said about the Gen Z crowd, and he previously referred to snowflakes in the dressing room and having to manage millennials. You can't underestimate having a grown up in that dressing room, because there are some who need pulling into line a lot of the time, and he's not going to care about reputations. He's got the experience. He's twice the age of some of the players in that squad, and the fact that he's actually played really well against Erling Haaland and played really well at Anfield, where United prevented Liverpool from scoring, that just shows you how well he's done this season. But also there have been other games where he's come in and his performance level has been good.
He shouldn't have left, should he, in the first place, really?
He should have.
Do you reckon?
Yeah. I this is the revisionism that people
fair enough forget. I mean, a couple of years later, Manchester City were interested. Terrific on the ball.
Yes, because, and I still maintain this, he's a better footballer than a defender. I think people underestimate what a brilliant footballer he is. But it's a quirk with him, because this was definitely the case during his first spell at United. He was better against the best strikers. If you pit him against, say, Rob Hulse, he would struggle. And he literally said that Rob Hulse was his toughest opponent. And that was the
Why is that then? Physicality?
I think the physical element of it, I think, Johnny Evans can handle himself as well, but he got a real going over from a number of physical forwards. In his last season at United, he was particularly bad at Stoke on New Year's Day, I think it was. And given his situation at United, where he was into the last year of his contract, him, Smalling and Phil Jones were all at the turning point, midway through the 14-15 season. Doesn't feel like that long ago at all, but there's a new generation to educate here. But midway through the 14-15 season, Evans, Smalling and Jones were into the last 18 months of their contract. And you knew that they couldn't all stay the next season. And come early March, Evans is starting. And then there's the incident with Papi Cisse up at Newcastle, where it looks like Evans has spat at him. And Evans is banned for 6 games. That opens up the opportunity for Jones and Smalling to start together. And United continue their winning run. And they get contracts on the back of it. Because Johnny Evans barely plays for United again. He's got a year left in his contract, so they decide he's going to get sold. And that's why he went to West Brom. But also, his form in the last, I'd say the last 5 years at United, bar calendar year of 2012, the season where they won the title in 2012-13, his form was not good. I mean, I've not even mentioned the worst or best example of his nadir at United. That was against Carlton Cole in the League Cup quarterfinal in 2010, where he got going over.
It's funny how players can improve in the mid to late 20s and actually come in, well, it's the premiers, I suppose, but they can, sometimes you think, right, this is it for a player that's around his level, but they can really take strides later on in their career.
I mean, I vividly recall February 2010 when they played away to AC Milan in the Champions League knockout stage, and they got Milan were all over them in the first half, but somehow United ended it, went in half-time at 1-1. But there's a clip of Ferguson telling Johnny Evans, effing wake up. And a few days later, Jack Rodwell bypassed him and he was all over the place as Everton beat United. And that calendar year, 2010, he was really poor and he didn't get much better in 2011. He had a minor, he had a bit of a resurgence in 2012, got a new contract on the back of it. But then, of course, Sir Alex Ferguson retired. Everybody struggled. Louis van Gaal came in and he decided he's the one who's got to go. So there's a lot of revisionism with Johnny Evans because, look, he's a better footballer than Phil Jones. He's a better footballer than Chris Smalling. But I'd have always said that Smalling was the better defender. Phil Jones, yeah, I mean, United made a number of errors in terms of his, you know, when they gave him contracts and suggesting that he was more important than he was. But there's a lot of context to that decision. It's not a decision that I've ever looked at and thought, God, they really, that was a clanger from them. It was completely understandable at the time. And look, there was a reason why he went to West Brom.
You made a compelling case, I must admit.
I have to, as I said, there's a new generation to educate that every time.
From one centre-back to another, perhaps another a younger replacement coming in the that area, Samuel. Jared Braithwaite, Amadou Onana as well. You've wrote the line today that United are still interested or continuing to monitor both of those players. Two names that have been linked, actually, over the last few months or so. Nothing really new on that front, but two very promising young players, and I guess both would be good additions to that squad in the summer.
Yeah, I was told this towards the end of last week. I thought, the time's not great, because ideally you'd put that story out before United play Everton, but It wasn't the right time to put it out. So I just thought, well, that's the Monday morning line taken care of. But in terms of centre half, as you said, it's inevitable that they're going to sign a centre back. I'd also say it's inevitable that they're going to sign a midfielder. There are going to be departures from both of those departments.
Could that be a new spine of the team? Centre half, centre midfield, and new striker. Because Martial's going to leave, and you can't just leave
that. Let's call it that square, if you like. You've got two corners of it in Martinez and Kobbie Mainoo, and ideally they would have two others there. I'm not necessarily suggesting that should be Jared Branthwaite, but you look at Branthwaite, and speaking to Joe Thomas, who's the Everton reporter at The Echo, he said that he's clearly a player that if a big club invests in him now, he'll be a brilliant player in years to come. Like, the obvious comparison to make, and I know it's a bit, it's very, very easy, is of course John Stones. Because obviously Stones was at Everton, came through at a young age, was a centre-back, and it was inevitable that he was going to get a big move at some point. He went to City in 2016, and look, he's a world-class defender. It's his development, I don't think anybody could ever foresee.
If John Stones joined United, then
he would not have been same player.
But no. That's why I'm looking at this thing in Branthwaite. He's shown such promise.
Well, I said to Joe, knowing full well that United were interested, oh, it would be a brilliant signing for City.
Because that's what it feels like, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully that changes now in Arsene here and things are going to be done different. But you do see young players linked to United and you think, are you going to the right place?
Well, young players have clearly looked at United in the past and thought, no. I mean, Erling Haaland and Jude Bellingham are the two most glaring examples of that. Benjamin Sesko is another one who decided to stay under the Red Bull umbrella and was starting the other night. I guess
Bradford's slightly different because he is English, isn't he? And Manchester United are still the biggest club in England. So,
well, you've got... This is why it's handy having Everton develop good players, because you know that Everton are never going to, as it stands anyway, they're never going to compete. They've not won a trophy since 1995. The North West, they're in the North West. A lot of Everton players live in Audley Edge. They live in Hale. There is no need to uproot. The lure of going to Manchester United, it's United don't even really need to make much of a pitch from that point of view. But obviously the goalposts have changed a lot over the last decade, because if you want to join a club in Manchester, it's a lot more logical to join City because of the structure, the setup. Look at the amount of players who've gone there and improved. How many bad signings have they made under Pep Guardiola? You could probably count on one hand. And Stones is, you know, it would be difficult for Branthwaite probably to overlook Stones as an example.
They've got so many centre-halves to play them at full-back, Samuel.
I know.
So there's need another one.
That's the latest evolution from Guardiola. First of all, it was playing full-backs in midfield, and then it's like, oh, that's old hat. I'm just going to play four centre-backs. And
now it's John Stones in the number 10 position, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, look, in fairness, with Nathan Ake, he has ample experience of playing at left-back, and Kyle Walker is an out-and-out right-back, and I'd say he's the best in the Premier League era as well. He's been a terrific player for City, and he was a pretty good player for Tottenham before that. But with Branthwaite, he does look like a smart signing. But whether should he be a starter for United next season? That's a different question altogether. But that's the dilemma they had a little bit with Bellingham. Bellingham wanted guaranteed minutes, and United couldn't guarantee him that. So that's why he made the decision to go to Dortmund instead.
Is Onana good enough for United? To start along
the Everton, when you look at that, not as a starter.
There you go. When you look at that midfield, potentially Casemiro leaves in the summer. I talked about Fernandes and Minu and someone else coming into that role, which for me is a potentially, if you get that player right, it could be a potentially title challenger. Yeah, but that is such a key position, and there's almost a lack of world class names available. Real Madrid have a couple, they're not going to sell. Declan Rice was the obvious candidate. That ship sailed, as we've mentioned. I don't think Onana's quite at that level, is he, right now?
Well, this is what...
Caicedo would have been. I mean, because I think Caicedo's been awful
United,
for Chelsea.
This is what United fans must pull their hair out. Camavinga, Tchouameni, Rice, Bellingham, Caicedo as well. These players, they had firmly established interest in, and they've not shied away from that. They didn't sign any of them. And who's the midfielder they did sign, who was of a similar age group, Mason Mount, who everybody is asking, is he a central midfielder? No.
Is he alive? He is. Well,
he was in the director's box. Yeah, he's in the, not,
no,
not
sorry, after the international break.
He was in the director's box again at the weekend. But, and we get into early October and Mount is taken out of central midfield and put on the right. And that is where, I mean, there are so many, the evidence of why the structure has not worked and why structural change is required is as high as this ceiling, probably higher in fairness.
We'll talk about Mount more, well, at the podcast before the Sheffield United.
But that is the frustrating thing. They could have, look, with Bellingham, okay, you know, they weren't promising him minutes. He was 17. Did anybody think he would turn out to be as great a player as he is? I didn't. But I mean, Birmingham retired his shirt number, so they clearly had a good idea. Camavinga came from Rennes. Tchouameni came from Monaco. But again, I think they've been in the right environment to succeed. I think Rice was a no-brainer. But you looked at United, the way they were going about their budgets each summer, they were never, ever going to be spending £100 million. If they had owners who invested in the club and made that money available, then it would have been doable. But that was a big one. I think
if you spent £86 million on Anthony a year and a half later.
And that's what undermines their case.
Yeah, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
Bang your head against the wall on that wall that you talked to in the mix zone.
Yeah.
Last season, Simon, in terms of what the result actually means, I mean, Aston Villa played Tottenham on Sunday afternoon. All eyes were on that game at Villa Park. Tottenham smashed them 4-0. Yeah. Villa got a man sent off. Quite inconsistent, Villa, considering their position in the league, I feel. They're very in and out. But yeah, 8 points ahead of United. Obviously, that gap was 11. Tottenham, 6 ahead in fifth, a couple of points behind Villa. I mean, we've kind of discussed this top four race throughout the season, and there's obviously the added dynamic of potentially fifth could get Champions League, as we discussed last week.
It was a bad week for the coefficients.
It was. God, are they going to do it?
Are United going to do it? I still think that they're dependent on the coefficients. I mean, I'm not surprised that Villa are wobbling, because they were wobbling after United beat them on Boxing Day. The fact that they played those two games against United and didn't win either of them, and then they have a big game at home against Tottenham, get battered against 4-0. They're looking like bottle jobs. Yeah, there.
You look at Villa's remaining fixture. Sorry for interrupting. I mean, they're still in Europe, so they've got Ajax at home. Manchester City away, Arsenal away, Chelsea at home, Chelsea are in now, and Liverpool at home. So
even Chelsea did them in the FA Cup.
So you've still got the three best teams in the Premier League to play, and Chelsea, who we'll mention in that breath. But a difficult run in that. A really difficult run.
Yeah, I don't think Villa will finish fourth on the basis of that. As I said, the fact that they didn't win either of those games against United, despite the auspicious positions they were in both games, was quite telling. And then they have a big game on Sunday at home to Tottenham, and they get thumped 4-0. I mean, you just look at them, you think you're a Europa team. They've done really well this season, but clearly they've not got the capabilities, I don't think, to sustain it and finish fourth. The only reason why they might is because Tottenham also are serial bottle jobs, and this is what would make it utterly galling for United if they were to finish below one of those teams, never mind both of them. Because if United had anything about them, top four would be a fait accompli. But because they've been so poor really this season, and they've bought badly and they've not got a style, and then they've struggled for goals, and they've had issues with this player and that player and various other, certainly the managerial situation, that's all up in the air as well. It doesn't help matters. But really, at the start of this season, I think people would have looked at it and thought, well, it'd be a surprise if United finished outside the top four, because Tottenham had just got a new coach. Chelsea are a bit of a basket case. The notion of Villa, who were managed by Steven Gerrard at the start of last season, finishing above United this season, would have been fanciful. Yeah.
Fourth had to be the bare minimum, though, because fourth was technically a regression. Obviously, you'd want them to at least get third, add a trophy to make any progress. But you're right, it's not been very good. I mean, I looked at Tottenham's schedule there as well. They've still got Arsenal and City and Liverpool to play. And of course, United have as well.
Yeah,
so it doesn't really make a difference.
But there's the problem. United have got to go on a real sustained, consistent run. They've got to be targeting 10 wins out of 10. I think if they get, it almost certainly won't happen, but if they get 10 wins out of 10, I'll be amazed if they've not finished in the top four. But although Tottenham and Villa will give them encouragement going into May, I think, I just don't think United have got it in them to win game after game after game, especially with the setbacks they've got. They're not going to have a left-back pretty much for the rest of the season. Marseilles isn't going to be back until April. Hoyland, hopefully, is back for the Liverpool game. That will have a big bearing probably on their run-in, but the stars have to align quite late in the day.
Arsenal game at home, and Old Trafford's the penultimate game of the season.
And then it's Brighton away.
That's going to be huge, that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Title decider, potentially. We'll leave it there for part two, and we'll be back in a minute for part three. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester It's Red podcast. Now, Samuel, on Friday afternoon, after the press conference, so obviously we did the podcast on the Friday morning, it was announced that Sir Jim Ratcliffe has enlisted the help of Sebastian Coe, or Lord Sebastian Coe, Andy Burman, Gary Neville, and the likes, to an Old Trafford task force, to regenerate the area. Now, the whole conversation has been about whether to revamp or rebuild. Ratcliffe is leaning towards rebuilding, instead of revamping. Do you want to expand a bit on that? Because I believe Burnham was in the Old Trafford press room, wasn't he, at the game on Saturday afternoon? Obviously, the Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, I should add.
Yes, he spoke to us for about 10 minutes just before kickoff. He's an Everton fan, and coincidentally, he did a press huddle before the Everton United game at Goodison over the points deduction Everton had been hit by. But he was stood with Ratcliffe when we were at the Munich Memorial last month, and he's held meetings with him. I was told that Ratcliffe is using people he needs, which, and the Manchester mayor is obviously going to be one of them, and Burnham is making the case for public money funding the regeneration, not just of the stadium.
Was he grilled
on
that point? Because it,
yes.
Very
rigorously.
It's obviously caught the attention of rival fans, and I'm not really so United fans talk about it because they're probably indifferent to the situation, but it is really interesting. I mean, this whole Wembley of the North talk, fantastic for United, but how does that really help anyone else?
Well, they're trying to talk a good game. They're saying that it can be a new hub in Manchester. If you join it up with Media City, it expands it. It creates leisure, places for leisure, lifestyle, gym, bars, what have you. Just, you know,
jobs.
Exactly. Creating jobs, creating a buzz and a place that... It's just really exists to accommodate football.
It exists for me to run.
It's
not much going on.
And Ratcliffe's trying to be a bit romantic about it, about the industrial aspect as well. But when he's talking about a Wembley of the North and a stadium that can host international matches, you've got the Etihad to do that because they've been on top of it. And when City expand, I think it's inevitable that the Champions League final will go to Manchester and it won't go to Old Trafford. It will go to the Etihad. So that's going to be another kick in the teeth. Now, fair enough, they want to trump City, as they should be, and as they had been doing until 2012. And bar one season, City have just been best in class over United in just about every single department. And Ratcliffe has come in and he wants to shake things up and he wants to change the tide. He wants to knock City off their perch. They've taken the City chief football operations officer, and there'll be a lot of other things that they'll want to do that is going to resemble Manchester City and the way Manchester City conduct things. If you go to the Etihad and you've got that bridge that links the stadium with the CFA, I mean, it's just that area, bar the green neon sign at the Asda, is blue. It is city centric. They've done a tremendous job, and that bridge was opened I think in 2014 or 2015. The CFA was opened in 2014. How far ahead of the curve they've been with that? How long have United been standing still for? The answer is since the Glazers came in. They've not overseen one single expansion. The last expansion was when the quadrants were installed in 2006. Plans for that were signed off in 2004. The Glazers completed their takeover in 2005. And so, of course, Ratcliffe is trying to talk a good game. He's trying to say this is in the public interest, but it's going to rankle with a lot of taxpayers if their money is going to be used to build new stadium for Manchester United.
There's already a taxpayers stadium in Manchester.
Exactly. So I don't blame taxpayers for saying, no, why should we do this? It's ridiculous. And especially when you have got at the very least, in terms of those who have some kind of investment or involvement at Manchester United, you've got three billionaires there. Ratcliffe is worth $29 billion. The Glazers siblings, billionaires, how much money have they got? But obviously, as was clear in that statement on Friday afternoon, there was not a single mention of the Glazers. There was not a Glazer sibling quoted. And that's because they've never put a single cent into Manchester United, and they never will do. So this is just Jim Ratcliffe's project. And I think it's quite telling that Sebastian Coe is going to be the chair of the task force. Coe, he's a Chelsea fan, so Ratcliffe would have encountered him when he went to Chelsea games. It's another one from the Knightsbridge crowd, it feels like. He has experience of London 2012. That's the key.
He's doing the right things to get political clout, to be fair to him. Ratcliffe is doing all the right things, whatever it actually comes
off. A lot of United fans will not like Seb Coe because he's a Chelsea fan, because he's a Tory, and they'd probably prefer a lot of them from a certain vintage.
Are you a conservative?
I don't declare who I vote, but I don't vote Conservative. I've never voted Conservative. No, no, no. I wasn't even one of those. Like when I was a student in 2010, they're like, oh, we're going to abolish students' fees. And all my student mates obviously decided to vote Lib Dems. Even then,
and you voted for the Green Party at the very start.
At this point, we get back to the football. But Co at least does have experience of transforming Stratford. And when Stratford was transformed for the London 2012 Olympics and there was that stadium there, you knew that stadium had to be occupied by a football club. And they were, Leighton Orient were trying to, because Stratford is nearer to Leytonstone than West Ham, they were trying to get into it. But it always had to be West Ham's ground as well. And I don't advise going there because it's chocker on most days because you've got the Westfield Shopping Centre. But that's kind of what Ratcliffe will want, whilst also maintaining the daily rituals that Manchester United fans have of going to Old Trafford and, you know, that not being compromised. I mean, it's not like they're going to move back to where it all started in Newton Heath. The stadium will be with the postcode M16.
Where do you stand on it then? Revamp or rebuild?
Rebuild.
Okay, well, I'm in the corner of redevelop, and there is obviously different elements to each argument. But I think history, you can't replace it.
There's one thing
George
standing.
Best, Bobby Charl, and
they've changed the pitch. God knows how many times since they played there. The stands are completely different. There's only one thing that's survived in that stadium from the war, and that's a wall in the tunnel between the dugout.
That doesn't matter, it's the feel of the stadium, isn't
it? But the stadium's going to be literally next door.
I get that, it is a perfect compromise. You'd much rather be on the same location.
I didn't see Martin Chivers or Jimmy Greaves, or when he was alive, Martin Peters, all these Gary Lineker, Paul Gascoigne, all these Spurs greats saying, the penalty spot, I remember it when it used to be there, but it's not there anymore.
Well, Spurs they've done an excellent job.
They've done an excellent job.
If United want to make a new stadium, you follow Spurs' way, because the ground is absolutely
You can have a bigger stadium. But when we spoke to Burnham on Saturday, there was one particularly rigorous exchange he had with a colleague about it, and he almost fumbled a little bit. He brought up the railway line as if citing the railway line behind the South Stand as the biggest reason why they have to move. And obviously taxpayers will say, well, if it's not in use, why don't you just build over it anyway? Why don't you just be careful about it? And then you're not having to use as much of our money. But in terms of whether it would be, in terms of revamping the stadium, obviously that taxpayers' money doesn't come into that because it's just a very gradual process, stand by stand. But Ratcliffe is 71. He's a man in a hurry. He would probably, if he had to grin and bear it and go with that, he would still be looking around and thinking, this is a missed opportunity here. And then if you've done that, you're not going to build a new stadium for another lifetime, probably. So I think the intent off the pitch so far from Ratcliffe and Eos is really laudable. And it's, they're saying the right things. I think I completely agree to do the new build as well, because I think that maximises that space behind the Stretford end, and you can create a modern fan park. I'm not a fan of fan parks, unsurprisingly, but most big clubs, if they've got a new stadium, that's what they've got. You're getting more money into the club as well. But the notion that taxpayers should foot a big chunk of the bill is fanciful. And even if, like, I think Burnham said that Everton with Bramley Moor Dock, a lot of taxpayers' money went into that. Everton clarified afterwards that it wasn't. They had a grant of some sort. It's very, very different. And that's why they took the Premier League around the grant and said, look, we're investing in this. This is why profitability and sustainability rules are an issue, because we want to create jobs for people in Liverpool. There were Liverpool fans last season, a lot of Liverpool fans last season, who didn't want Everton to go down because it would have been bad for the city. It would have been bad for people losing jobs. It would have had a detrimental impact.
Would have been funny to see that stadium in the Championship, though. Is that brutal? Probably.
It is quite brutal.
In terms of time frame, how long do you think it's going to take? I think it's an important point you make that Ratcliffe is 71 and you just described him as a man in a hurry. He's coming into this, and we don't want to be inappropriate about how long he's,
But Burnham said they want to have essentially have the findings from this task force that they've set up. They want the findings by middle of the year or autumn. So that's
and what's the time frame that's when you've done your pieces on a new build? What's been the time frames estimate on this?
I can't remember. I did a piece on
is it 5 years?
A year ago.
I remember reading it, but I can't exactly remember the date. No, fair enough if you can't either.
I've done a lot yeah. on the stadium, but I think essentially it would be quicker to do a new build than to do the existing stadium stand by stand.
Yeah, I got
which
that.
Is another incentive. And I don't think the difference in cost would differ too much either, which is maybe a little bit surprising, but I remember being told that well over a year ago, and that informed a piece that I did. I think it was during the March internationals last year, so that's how far you're going
back. Do you think fans can have much of a difference in this scenario? I mean, they've already kind of made which way they're leaning quite clear. They're going to consult Muss and people who live around Old Trafford, etc., and other fan groups. Do you think their opinions, obviously they will be sought and they will be considered, but do you think they'll actually make a difference? They have said it, but do you think they will actually make a difference?
I think if Ratcliffe wants a new build, he'll have a new build.
That's
my
point.
Essentially, I'll say, well, look, I'm giving you a better stadium. It's on a better, it's on the same site. You're going to have, you say, same daily match day ritual, sorry. And I'm sure if they were to do that, they would do their utmost to keep the supporters who sit and stand together. Because that's been another issue this season where there've been a lot of upset fans in a block of the Sir Bobby Charlton stand being relocated next season to accommodate hospitality seats. They're not expanding hospitality, they're just relocating those hospitality seats because there was a lot of fans kicked off when they were put in the Stretford end, and they're being taken out of the Stretford end and put in the South Stand, which is probably what the more mild man, probably the most mild mannered stand.
But there are a lot of the Tory stands.
I think that's very, very harsh.
It's a joke. It's just the politics.
I think these lovely people are emailing me and asking me to get on to the club. They'll take umbrage at that. But there was one lady who's, I think, was born in 1949, and she's been a season ticket holder for well over half a century, and she's
Norman Whiteside's in that stand as well.
Yeah, his wife Dee obviously brought everyone's attention to it as well. So I sympathise with fans over that. I mean, United have communicated their decision and the reasons behind it, but that would be something to consider as well in terms of the new build. You wouldn't want fans just randomly scattered here, there and everywhere. You'd want an atmospheric hub. You'd want to retain the identity of the Stretford end, if at all possible, and how would that fit in with the layout? Because of course the stadium would rotate if it was a new build, just to maximize the space that they have on the site.
And I know it probably goes without saying, because we haven't really said it, but it's fantastic, isn't it? I haven't actually praised these plans, but incredibly ambitious. It's what we've been wanting to see.
Yes.
Ratcliffe is doing everything that Qatar promised, but without the sports washing. It's true.
Without the sports washing, and
he's real.
Sir Jim Ratcliffe exists. So Sheikh Hasim has not denied that he doesn't exist. Since,
fake Sheikh.
Exactly.
Fake
that Sheikh. Was, the deep fake Sheikh, I think, if you were to go off some of his social media images. But this is what a lot of fans have been waiting for. I mean, in fairness, they started, about 2 years ago, Populous, the stadium master planners, were hired to present plans for a new build or redeveloping Old Trafford. Then those plans are put on hold because of the strategic review, so that's caused the delay. But as you said, they gained regulatory approval less than 3 weeks ago. And when I spoke to Ratcliffe in Knightsbridge, he said about something, we can talk about that next week. And that was clearly this, and it was delayed by another week. But that's how that just shows you how he is a man in a hurry.
In a hurry.
And that's what United need. They've had owners who couldn't care less, really, about what the stadium looks like, about what fans think, because they're the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. You've got a guy there who was born in Failsworth, grew up in Failsworth, grew up a United fan. And although he's been an extraordinarily successful man, I think he knows that this is what he's going to be remembered for, what he does with Manchester United.
Do you think the Glazers will have the cheek to show the face again when United are playing well and actually, hopefully, challenging for the title?